Welcome everyone to Know Their Brand podcast, a podcast designed to champion and support gender inclusion in business. Welcome everyone. I'm Giulia, your host, a social entrepreneur dedicated to helping women in business. Join me and my fantastic guest to find out more about gender inclusion and to be inspired by their incredible stories. Hello, everyone. Today we have with us Fiona Murden. She is a psychologist and she is the author of one of my absolute favorite books called Mirror Thinking. And so I'm very excited today to have Fiona with us. Hi, Fiona.
Hi, Julia. Do you know what? I think I should soundbite that recording because A, I love your voice and your accent on top of that, but B, I mean, what an introduction, my absolute
I love that book. It was a common friend introduced me to the book and I devoured it. I think everybody honestly should read it. It's really open-minding. And what I think when I said it once to you is like, once you start thinking in terms of mirror thinking, you can stop it. You just see it all the time. And you're like, why I never realized it before. But before we go any further, it's important that we explain to the audience, what is mirror thinking? Can you give us, I know it's a massive topic because it's an entire book, but if you can give us a little explanation of what it is and why it's important to be aware of it.
So I guess the easiest way to explain it is how it was discovered, which, and this might involve you helping me with my pronunciation, okay, because it was actually discovered in Italy by a man called you can have to take that bit out. Rizzolatti, basically. I think, okay, I can say the second bit. So he's a neurophysiologist. And in 1992, him and his team were trying to work out which bits of a monkey's brain were responsible for the hand grasping motion. And they were literally looking down to single neurons, so the single cell level of passing on information from one cell to another, which we can't do in humans because it involves taking the top of the skull off. which, so unfortunately, these poor macaque monkeys were being experimented on. And one day the team were sat in the same room as the monkeys eating their lunch, and they noticed that the monkeys' brains were firing, so they were active in the motor cortex responsible for grasping, even though they were sat there still, just looking at the researchers. And they realized that what was happening was, as they were bringing their sandwich to their mouth or their pizza or whatever they were eating, the monkeys were mirroring that action in their own brain without actually moving.
Wow.
And that's where the term mirror neuron came from. And basically what was discovered was it's the mechanism by which we learn most things. So we learn by observation, and that refers to everything from sport, so playing a sport like hitting a tennis ball, kicking a ball, through to understanding other people's intentions, which we're also mirroring in our own brain to try and work out what's happening. Empathy, again, that's something where we're mirroring someone else's emotion, not to the same extent, but in the same way in our own brain as in someone else's. And all of these things also enable us to interpret the social and emotional world around us, because we don't enact everything we see. We observe and we assimilate and we play it through in our own brain. And so it goes from everything from observational learning of the things that may seem most obvious, like sport, through to the tiny little nuances of our emotional intelligence and our social understanding.
Yeah, you, in your book, you present a lot of interesting examples. It starts from yourself when you moved school, and I felt very connected to that because that happened to me as well. You know, we both moved school to a very different setting. And in order to fit in, what we do was to mirror the people around us, even though it was negative for us. Like we were both conscious that it was not a good thing. In my case, I had to learn a lot of swear words. I really had to, because I was coming from a very different background, and in new school, everybody was swearing all the time. And I had to learn them and just to fit in. And even though I knew that I shouldn't speak that way, but it was like a survival mechanism. And I think something similar happened to you, right, when you moved to school.
Yeah, and what's interesting is teenagers, we think of ourselves as adults as, yeah, when you're a teenager, you're really influenced by what's going on around you. We're as influenced as adults, but we're not as aware. So actually, when you're a teenager, you're more consciously observing your environment and working out what you need to do in order to fit in, and more consciously aligning with those behaviours. Whereas later in life, we're just as influenced in many ways, not in all ways, as when we're teenagers, but there's a slight arrogance in adulthood that we're not. But we are at 95%, if not more, of our cognitive activity is unconscious. And one massive factor of that is observational learning. So it's how we're fitting into the social norms and behaviours and cultures around us.
Which I suppose then brings us to a big problem, which is probably, and correct me if I'm wrong, but biases then become a result of this, us trying to fit in and observing and trying to be like everyone else. And then someone recently talked to me and he said, you know, there is this big myth of meritocracy, but actually I call it a mirocracy, which is, but in Italian it's very difficult to pronounce. Imagine the word mirror and crassy, they put them together. And that because she was on this podcast and she was explaining that we basically look at people that are like us, or that we, you know, we just look for similarities. We observe and look for similarities. Is that, do you think that would be a good explanation of biases and things that happens in the workplace?
Yeah, it's one of the things. It's one of definitely one of the many things that come into play. And again, it's our brain conserving energy by what we can only focus our attention on certain things at a certain time. And the rest of what goes on for us is subconscious to enable us to navigate the world. And so we do mirror the people around us, and particularly if they are people like us. So the closer we are emotionally to someone, the more like us someone is, from ethnic background, preferences, values, the more exposed we are to people, the more likely we are to mirror them.
Okay. And so when you talk about being, do you think we are going to be influenced? So we have been influenced because they look like us, because we observe their behavior. And so this has a massive impact, I suppose, when we talk about role modeling and, you know, having a positive, looking at someone up and trying to imitate. I remember, for instance, in your book, you talk about that when the role of siblings, which is very, very interesting. I don't have siblings, but I could really place it like in people that I know with siblings. But you also said, you know, if someone is particularly good at school, for instance, one sibling is particularly good at school, chances are the other ones can either imitate and try to be good at school, or being the opposite. And I realized that happened to me. I don't have siblings. My mom went to university when I was at university. She was just like 2 years ahead of me, and she was smashing it. And it irritates the hell out of me because I wasn't as good as her. But I realized that having her as a role model, or someone that, you know, close to me that I can mirror, yeah, it could have gone either way. Either I would have given up because there was no chance that I could be as good as my mom, or you just follow into, okay, if that's the way we do university, that's the way you do university, and we do it well. And eventually I did get great results. And after I finished your book, I called my mom and I said, thank you very much. You probably didn't do it intentionally, but I think it was thanks to you that I did so well at university. Is that something you see in your work?
Definitely. And there's different factors to it. There's being able to see the route through and understanding what that is, both from understanding how to navigate socially, but also what that path looks like, how you do it, what good looks like. that actually I did a talk on mirror thinking and role modeling yesterday, and one of the audience, he said that he came from a working class background. Both his parents left school when they were quite young, and he was very good at chemistry, and it was because his friend's father was a headmaster who he sat him down and explained what the route through looked like, how to get there. And okay, that's an explanation, but it's an explanation that paints a picture of what someone else has done and what the possibilities are. And that opens up doors where, you know, there's the expression, we have to see her to be her, or we have to see it to be it. And it's very true. It's very hard to be able to be the pioneer, the first person making our way through. And because our world is so fragmented and complex, sometimes it's difficult to see those people to emulate, or they're too far away from us to actually have a personal impact. And so we have to look and make the effort to see that. And then there's the I can't remember what it's called, the academic spillover effect of siblings. Yes, that they may not be consciously even mirroring, but if an elder sibling does well, there's evidence to show that a younger sibling will do well. And you take up all the other factors that are involved, and that's about academic achievement in a purest sense, being modelled from an older to a younger. But then there's also this counter mirroring, which I call it, when you deliberately do the opposite to a sibling, or not just a sibling, to anyone. So again, yesterday, someone in the audience said they'd had their first role at work. These were chief execs talking to yesterday. And so all people that had, in society's eyes, become very successful. She said her first role as a graduate was into a really bullying environment. And she looked at the behavior of her boss there and she thought, I am never, ever going to be like that. I am never going to behave like that. And we see that as well, because if you're making a conscious decision to do something or not do something, it makes it far more powerful. So that counter mirroring, that deliberate, I do not want to be like that, can sometimes actually be stronger and more reinforced in terms of how the outcome of our behavior than if we're just sort of bumbling along and not really realizing that we're copying what someone else is doing, because in effect, that's what we're doing.
Oh, I love, there is so many things here. At today, I haven't read The Lord of the Rings because my cousin was, we were the same age, and she was the good one at school, and we were in the same class. And I remember that I made a conscious decision not to read the book because everybody was saying how good she was, that she was so young and she already had read the entire book. And at today, I didn't get close to that book. I'm still going against it.
Are you?
Well, I will do it one day. They made it a movie. They spoiled it for me. I did read The Hobbit, but I didn't read the because... But for me, it was like a separation, right? You know, become my own self. It was like avoiding intentionally. But the one other thing you mentioned is like, we look like the person in your audience that was inspired by the headmaster. Actually, when I did some degree in higher education, one thing they say, actually lower education, is that if you want more children in STEM, you need to expose them to people the work in STEM. Yeah. After that, I brought my children to speak with one of our friends that is an engineer. I was like, tell us a bit about your work. What do you do? Because it's true, if you don't see it, like my children are not exposed to that kind of thing. Both my husband and I, we work in, you know, an office, and it's like nothing to do with STEM. So how can they be inspired to become scientists, or how they can be inspired to do anything different than what they see day in, day out from us? They need to be exposed, otherwise you can't dream it. And in the same way, and you know that I work in gender equality, I was talking the other day at an event, is that how can a young woman think of becoming a scientist if all the books that she reads have pictures of men, if every time there is a talk is a man talking about something? Like, you can't just portray yourself there, because it just doesn't look like you. It doesn't resonate. Right.
It doesn't resonate. And exactly. And as you were talking, I just pulled up, because I'll get the numbers wrong if I don't have it in front of me, a piece of research. So Microsoft did a piece of research spanning 12 European countries, including 12,000 females aged 11 to 30. And it showed that the number of girls and young women interested in STEM on average almost doubles when they have a role model.
You see?
I mean, that's significant.
And doubles. Wow. Double.
And then if you look at someone like Melinda Gates, she talked about her father and how he was in STEM and he inspired her. And I spoke to this really interesting woman who, Karen Nyberg, who's an astronaut. She's an American lady. And she's spent 6 months on the International Space Station. And I said to her, do you feel the pressure that being a role model as a female brings? And she sort of looked quite crestfallen. I felt really bad for asking the question because she said, yes, I do. I do. I know that I am a role model, and I have a duty, as it were, to play that, to share the information, the experiences I've had for another generation. But what's also interesting is you look at someone like Karen Nyberg, and she is a pioneer, and she was one of the first 50 females in space. But not everyone is like that. So those people are the exception, not the rule. So there's two facets to that. One, other people may look at them and think, well, I couldn't do that. Not that I couldn't be in space or I couldn't take that career path, but I couldn't be the person pioneering and breaking down those barriers. But it will enable more people to come through. But there needs to be the next wave, which feel more attainable, in terms of they're not breaking down as many barriers. It feels more accessible. It feels more normal. And that's one of the dangers, I think, with the role models who are absolutely leading the way, is they are doing things that most people will see as, I couldn't do that. That doesn't feel possible for me. Exactly. But it's still a step in the right direction.
No, absolutely. But I resonate with that because sometimes I actually wrote an article about that, and the danger of super mom, super women, super, they become so super that you look at them and you can't resonate with them. And when I look, for instance, a super female entrepreneurs and they raise millions and billions, and I'm like, that's amazing. But I can't relate. I need someone that is more in my space to look at and learn from, and to inspire me. Because I can say maybe in 10 years, 20 years, maybe I will be, but it's not even something I possibly want to achieve that. So that is important to see these women to be inspired, but that is the middleman. And the same we say at work, when you have a company that has maybe as a one female CEO, but in all the management, there are very few female. Yeah, that CEO can be inspiring, but the junior that starts the career there, they need someone more closer to them to be inspired to grow and go the next level up in their career. It's not a female CEO that will be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why sometimes it can be someone helping you see the way through, even if there isn't someone who's taken the exact path that you're going to take. And it's having that person who's championing you and understanding you and cheering you on. It can be really important.
But that's the role of the mentors, right? You're very interested in mentors. I think you're creating an app to connect mentors with mentee. I wrote on mentors and mentees just the other day, a topic that I'm very passionate. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, so we've got a platform which is with three organizations currently, matches mentors and mentees based on behavioral and personality based factors. But then it also provides the tools to help with that, because mentoring is, like role modeling, one of the most natural ways of learning. But the problem becomes we live in a far more complex world than we were evolved to live in. So whilst, I might have followed around an elder in a tribe in thousands of years ago, and I would have seen what they did and what they came across and how, And they will have seen how to nurture the person below them. We don't see that. We don't have the community that we traditionally have. And so it seems ridiculous, but you need to help people understand how to optimize that type of relationship. What does that mean? What does it look like? What factors do you bring to it and what don't you? What are the rules of the game? And so we put those in as well as helping people understand themselves a bit better. So whether they're a mentor or a mentee, because to be a better mentor, you have to understand yourself better, because that then enables you to bring more, but it also then enables you to grow from the experience. So it's about growth and support and being believed in. The interesting thing I think that I've read quite a few places about mentoring, which from a psychological perspective I take issue with, is people say that, you know, you come to mentoring with very explicit goals. Mentoring is not about that. So there might be, someone might come along with a list and say, I've got these three goals, will you help me with them? Yeah. But someone else may not get to the goals throughout the whole relationship. But the point is, mentoring is about a supportive relationship where someone feels like they're believed in. And if that means that that's all they get, well, I mean, amazing, isn't that an amazing thing? But if it means that it's more instrumental and it's more like tangible, fine. It's really about, I mean, the whole thing about mentoring is it should be about what that mentee needs, and helping that mentee understand what they need is a big part of that.
I personally love mentorship. I'm lucky enough to have a mentor and to mentor two people, a man and a woman. They chose me. I didn't. They actually called me their Amazing. Mentor. I was like, you know, because now that you're my mentor, oh, you're such a good mentor. I'm like, am I? What? Me? Mentor yours? Ooh, wow. I was very, very... But now I took my role. And actually, one thing that you said is very important. And actually, I didn't realize until after I read your book, is that when you become a mentor, you need to be responsible for what you do. In a sense, you can't just disappear. And, you know, you were talking about programs that are done in communities where people with, you know, with no hope, if you want, young people, and then there are adults that come in and become these role models, these mentors, but then they drop off for whatever reason. And that is even worse, is even more counterproductive than, you know, not being there in the first place. I think I take, after reading your book, I really take my mentorship, now that I've been told that I'm a mentor, I take my mentorship role very seriously, because I realize that they rely on me, and you can't just disappear in the same way that I rely on my mentor. And it's a very important role that we play. And I, like you, I don't think there are agendas, like, can we have a call because I need help with this, and that's totally fine. But, you know, it's more a growing. And I think for me personally, I'm growing even when I mentor, not just when I'm mentored, whatever is the verb, because they give us different perspective on things. And, you know, they, even just talking to them, I explore sides of myself. I didn't realize that.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting, because mentoring has so many benefits, tangible benefits, measurable, research, proven, evidence-based benefits, like improving well-being, improving your emotional intelligence, your leadership skills. But one thing that's really hard to put a finger on is that people enjoy it. They get something from it. And one of our investors, actually, who is a psychologist and in the same field as me, so an occupational psychologist, so I was slightly surprised when they asked this question, was, but what's in it for the mentors? You don't need to even put something on it. People want to do this. There are actually, a lot of the time, we have more mentors than we do mentees, because people want to do it, and it's an emotional thing. It's not a rational thing. You can rationalize it and you can come out with the reasons why, but it feels fulfilling.
It is fulfilling.
It's nurturing. It's what we're meant to do as humans. I mean, it is one of the core things that we're meant to do as humans, is to nurture and pass on our skills and our understanding and support and enable other people to fulfill their potential.
Exactly. So I always say, what's the knowledge if you just keep it for yourself? You know, what you do with that? The purpose is to pass it on, or your experience, or your expertise. It's I personally find it extremely fulfilling. What frustrates me is that now, as everybody wants to do mentorship in, or not everybody, but a lot of companies are taking mentorship as a, we're going to support our talent, especially female talent. We're going to give them a mentor and that will solve our problem. Then they are not given the right tools. So the poor mentors don't know what they're doing. The mentee don't know what they're supposed to do. There is no tracking of if the relationship is working, is not working. What is the, you know, at the end, you know, in over time, is there any progress? Are people happy or not? So they become really a ticking box exercise where the company said, we have a mentorship program. You know, we are doing the best for our talent. And in fact, nobody is gaining anything from there because there is no progression of the relationship.
Yeah. And actually on that point, if anyone listening has a mentoring program and they want it to be evaluated, then please do get in touch, because I'm working with a data scientist on their MSc over the summer, so I don't want them to not have enough data. But we're looking at actually the effectiveness of various mentoring relationships and what factors play into that.
Okay, so call to action.
Yeah, get in touch.
Get in touch with Fiona. But I would like also to stress how mentorship, the importance of mentorship, and again, mirror thinking. And I what call, you know, the importance of hope, if you want. Like if you think back at the children coming from a poor background, I was actually discussing this with a colleague of mine recently, because they don't see anything else. So if you grow up in a neighborhood where everybody, someone said recently, all my neighbors were drug dealers or, you know, prostitutes. And so how can you imagine yourself outside that environment? And that's why we are mentorship programs where, you know, people from different, maybe same background, but they went to do something else, come in and trying to help these people. But I think that the importance of role modeling, mentoring, is really giving hope. Because if you don't have hope, you're not going to even try.
No. And it's, you know, if someone, having someone believe in you, it's very difficult to believe in yourself if you don't feel that anyone else believes in you, particularly when you're young. And the point that you made earlier, there was research of a program done in Manchester with young people who the government put a lot of money in the UK into supporting them through a mentoring scheme, but not thinking about how that was done. And so mentors dropped out because mentors didn't know what they were doing. They didn't understand the level of commitment required. And the crime rates actually increased as a result of that in this population, and levels of depression. Because these kids, they'd been given hope and then it was taken away from them again, which means that they then become less trusting. But also, if you think about all the factors that play into mirror thinking, we'll mirror what's around us. So if being part of a gang is what's around us, then we will do that. And if that's how we, our basic social needs are met, that feeling of belonging, then of course we're going to do that, because that's there. But the evidence that shows that if those kids in those less advantaged populations do have positive role models that stick with them, the impacts are absolutely incredible. And there's one guy actually I spoke to when I was launching the book, and he'd been sent to prison for 10 years for drug dealing. And he said when he went to prison, he sat there and he thought, I don't want to go down this route. This is not what I want from my life. And so he got out early, you know, on good behavior and what have you. And now what he does is he works with young people in the populations that are similar to the one he grew up in, and said, don't do what I did. But it's interesting when I talked to him, he's called Junior Smart, by the way. And when I went back through, well, what was life like for you? his mum and his sister were consistent role models for him. So although he did go off the rails and although he did get involved in sort of bad stuff, he had that grounding of people that were there as a consistent support. And every single person that manages to get themselves out of those sorts of situations will have someone somewhere who has consistently supported them. We can't do it on our own.
No, we can't. And that's why we need role models, and that's why we need mentors. And that's why as privileged people, we should try also to role model and to mentor, because we have the power to really impact life. That's what I was also teaching at university. I'm a coach on rugby, you know. At all these touch points, I need to remind myself that I am role modeling some kind of behavior. And, you know, it's important that I'm conscious. And that's something I really like of your book, is being conscious of what you're doing. I'm not saying that you have to be, it's impossible to be constantly conscious, especially for me, of all of my, you know, all of my emotions and things. But when I'm, when I'm teaching, when I'm with, especially with the kids at rugby, you know that you want to make sure that what they see is a positive role model. That is something that they can, you know, the girls and the boys become used to see a female coach, which I think is very important. Also how I behave, like if there is, you know, in rugby, we're very respectful. So at no point you're going to say, oh, I disagree with the referee, for instance. You don't do that because you want the children to learn that you don't do that. You know, small things, but you constantly have to remind yourself and be conscious of what children see when they see you as their coach, because it has an impact on them, I think.
Absolutely. And, I say, being a good role model, I remember, because it's front of mind from the talk I gave yesterday, but it's about being curious, it's about being committed, and it's about being connected. And the curious piece is remaining aware, and the committed piece is you don't let someone down. If you're a senior leader and you have a mentee and you think, oh God, you know, I can't make that. I've got a really important board meeting. I'm going to shift it. Can I get my PA to shift the meeting in a couple of weeks? That might not mean anything to you. You might not think twice about it, but the person you're mentoring, that sends a signal to them that they don't matter. So things like that, and being committed to thinking, I am responsible here, that people are watching me. But it doesn't mean you have to be perfect. And I think that's also where the curious comes in, because it's saying, okay, how am I behaving? Hold it lightly, think about it, adapt, grow, learn, say when you've made mistakes, explain what you haven't done right. And you know, be aware that nobody's perfect. No one's asking anyone to be perfect. And then emotionally connect with the people that you're with, because that's when it's going to have the biggest impact, if you emotionally connect with them.
See, it's interesting what you're talking about. You know, nobody's perfect. Now it's something I need to discuss with you, because, you know, I'm very passionate about vulnerability and show you vulnerability. I'm tired of people pretending to be perfect, as I was said before, the super mom, the super manager, the super, because we are human. We make mistakes. I'm trying to show to my children that we make mistakes, that we fail, you apologize. Like I was raised, for instance, I adore my mom. One thing I really didn't like, she told me when my boys were born, never apologize to your children. I'm like, I never liked that. And actually I do apologize to my children. Again, opposite mirroring, because I was like, because I remember feeling like, well, you clearly made a mistake. I see it, you know, why I'm not saying sorry for that. So I'm doing it to my kids. But then the other day, I posted that I was doing the comedy show. I was asked to introduce, present at this comedy show. And I posted that I was slightly terrified, because one thing is to present, you know, for work and talk about gender inclusion. That's what I do all the time. But being on a stage where people are expecting you to be funny, and, you know, there is a pressure that comes on. And I put that I was slightly terrified. And as much as people at the beginning were very supportive, you're going to be great, blah, blah. Afterwards, what I noticed, it went extremely well. Now, the people that didn't know that I said that I was stressed about it, they were like, oh, that was fantastic, amazing, you know. But people that knew they were like, so how did you feel? Was it okay? Like the tone was much, there was an expectation that I would have failed. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So I opened up myself to be vulnerable, but what is the the feedback wasn't what I expected. People just assumed that I did badly just because before doing it, I expressed self-doubt. So what is your take on that? I'm just interested.
It's really interesting listening to you, because it doesn't surprise me actually that people, and I think partly from a personal perspective, because I will say something like that and then I will get that sort of feedback. And then I think, well, did they think I was going to be rubbish? And then you actually look at it rationally and you think, well, no, it's because of the tone that you set beforehand and your own self-doubt. There's yesterday, again, conversation came up about when and where are you vulnerable? So one CEO in the room said that he had had a fatality in his workforce, and he was told legally not to go and talk to that family, that, you know, the relations of this fatality. And he said, but morally, he felt like he had to, and that made him vulnerable, but he did that. And we were talking about the nuance, and actually a friend of mine calls it insightful vulnerability. And I think particularly when you're a leader, it's thinking about when are you vulnerable and how are you vulnerable? Because actually, if you look too vulnerable, you undermine people's confidence and people start worrying and they think, well, I mean, if he or she is like worried about this, I should be really worried because, oh my goodness. But then there's also the type of vulnerability that says, actually, I'm human. I'm fallible. I worry. I get concerned. But the nuances of trying to read that are not straightforward. It's not just like a blanket, I'm going to tell you everything that I'm feeling. And I'm actually, another chief exec I was speaking to recently, he called it brain puke. I think he said basically that he's trying to change the culture of his organization, because at the moment, people just, they're under the impression that everyone can go around showing all their emotions all the time. And he said, it's just not helpful. And that's interesting as well, because you think, we know, then trying to explain to a culture of a whole population of people, we're not trying to tell you not to be authentic. We're not trying to tell you not to be vulnerable, but we're trying to get you to just pause and think before you say things. So I think it's really nuanced. And I think it's really nuanced, even more nuanced when you're a role model and when you're a leader. And it's something you need to actually think through, which sometimes you think, what? And then other times it's just a bit brain pukes. Okay. I think it's just like, be yourself, let it out, just show whatever. But the thing about psychology, the thing about behavior, which I love and which also frustrates me, because we can't capture it via things like social media, is the nuance.
Yeah, I think you made a great point, is the nuance. Because when that happened, I remember I commented on that with my husband. He was like, well, what were you expecting? You know, you just said to everybody that you don't think you're good enough. Then what are you expecting people to believe? I was like, no, that's not what I said. Just, you know, in my mind it was clear, but it wasn't, obviously. And I love the point you make about, you know, if you look too vulnerable, then people, they get scared. So you need, it's especially as a leader, I imagine that there is a lot of pressure on being, you know, the one that drives the ship, but at the same time shows vulnerability. It's not an easy path to.
No, it's definitely a tightrope, and it keeps me in the job I'm in. I mean, I've got the platform, yes, but one thing I will never stop doing is coaching, which is a form of mentoring, I guess. But it keeps me in tune with what's happening in different industries, and I always really appreciate being allowed into someone's life like that, to be a sounding board. And I think that's something you have to treat with respect, because, you know, I might think, well, they're not going to listen to me, they're a chief exec of an organization, but the fact is they will. And so I have to be careful what I advise or what I say. And like you say, it's not walking around being conscious the whole time, because that would be just damn hard work apart from anything else.
Exactly.
But it is thinking about those moments when we are on display to kids or to someone where it matters, and then just pausing and thinking, right, what am I doing here? How am I coming across? What impression am I leaving? What and message am I giving?
Exactly. And what impact I'm going to have, because it is powerful. And it is powerful in the small things. As I mean, obviously, as a leader of an organization, it's more powerful. Like, you can see the impact bigger. And if you are coaching someone that has that impact, it's going to be even bigger. But even in the small thing, I mean, for me, there are so many things that your book gave me. That's why I said what I said about the book. there is the be conscious of what you do, like to be in the moment, not to constantly just being. I'm not a person that is particularly driven that says, oh, tomorrow I need to do this all in my life. I want, that's my goal. I'm not that kind of person, but be conscious to be in the moment and to realize what the impact of what you're doing has, I think is one of the key takeaways. And there was another one, very briefly, I would like to touch upon, and then you mentioned, which is empathy, because I'm very empathic, but I think it's funny because in my family, we are very different. They're very empathic people and very non-empathic people. And you can see a difference. Also my children, you know, one of them is very empathic, the other one is the opposite. But then you talk about the importance of be aware of your empathy. So going back to be conscious, that's why it triggered this thought, because you were sharing the story of one time you be over empathic with someone when you're starting as a psychologist, and they, you see, I studied your book and memory pretty much, but by heart. She was fired, if I remember correctly, and you empathized to the point that she needed you all the time. She was calling you. You couldn't manage the relationship with her anymore. And so empathy, as much as you say that is good, also needs a bit of conscious thinking. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the best example with empathy is medics, doctors, because empathy levels are actually shown to drop in, I believe it's year 4 of medicine, which is when doctors are first exposed properly to real patients. So you're like, oh, what's going on there? So that, you know, we can theorize about what's going on there. One hypothesis is that it's because they're trying to protect themselves. So doctors will tend to shut down their empathy as a protective mechanism. But we also know that empathy improves patient outcomes. Yes. But there's interesting research. So some research shows that increased empathy in doctors prevents burnout in the doctors themselves. Mm-hmm. Other research says increased empathy in doctors increases burnout. And so I was like, what is going on there? And this hasn't been tested, but putting the research together, there are two types of empathy. There's cognitive empathy and emotional empathy. And cognitive empathy is, it's a bit like, say it's like this. So you're driving your car, someone pulls out in front of you, they shout at you, and you think, come on, that's not you. That's not me. I haven't done anything wrong. You just pulled out in front of me. I had to brake. You feel really angry. You could then get out of the car and start shouting at that person. Or you could think, that's really, really, you know, you're angry, but you don't act on it. And it's similar to that. So the emotional empathy is what we feel. So when we see someone upset, we feel that feeling, unless we've closed it down, which is another completely different. But the cognitive empathy is then saying, what do I do with that? So what do I do with what I'm feeling here? I'm feeling this person's feeling. What do I do with it? And that's the place that I think it's helpful to get to. And I think if we tested the doctors that were protected from burnout, that is probably the place they were using their empathy in a cognitive empathy way rather than an emotional empathy way. But no one trains us how to do that. And as a psychologist, initially I was using my emotional empathy. I very quickly learned through that experience, and she did get help and we did sort it all out. But I learned there's a point at which you can empathize and you can show genuine care and concern for someone else, but it doesn't mean you're taking on board all of those emotions. You're thinking about it from a rational standpoint.
Yeah, maybe just to explain, because I don't know if I explained it correctly before. So this person was fired, and you took the emotional, what she was going through, upon yourself, basically. You kind of felt the same way, and that make your relationship very close, but close to the point that she needed you to continue to survive, basically. Yeah. And then was not an healthy relationship to have between the two of you. So that is what we sometimes I find myself doing. Like, I'm just so empathic that I take the whole shebang on me, and then I don't know how to get out of it, because at that point you're completely intrinsically.
Well, you become enmeshed, and the difficulty there is you can't really help someone fully. And the whole purpose of empathy from an evolutionary perspective is to help. So you feel someone else's pain, you help them. So it's actually, that is why we believe we have empathy, is to take action on someone else's pain. But when you get enmeshed in that emotion, you can't help them, because you're then, it's like, oh, actually, I think Brené Brown does a lovely thing. It's like, well, actually, that's probably not a good example, because she gives the example of, I think someone's down a hole and they're feeling really, really down. And the bear puts a ladder down the hole and they climb down the hole to be with them. That actually is emotional empathy, because you're in the same place. Exactly. You might actually want to be leaning over from the top of the hole and just checking that person's all right, but you don't want to fall in the hole yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much. Well, we covered so much, from mirroring, from mirrorocracy, I still cannot say that, to mentoring, role modeling, empathy. I think that there is so much. I really generally recommend people to read your book, because there is so much you can learn about ourselves, how we behave with other people, how to be conscious of our behavior, and actually empowering ourselves as well to be more of a role model, and to realize that we can have an impact on people's life if we want to. But if we do that, just be aware of what we're doing. So thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really hope you enjoyed this episode. If so, please support us by liking it, by subscribing to our channel, and by sharing with your friends. It might seem such a small thing, but actually it will help us a lot.
And stop.